Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our phone number, 866-303-2270. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to airamerica.com, and there should be a link there. This is live chat. Click on that. It'll drop you right into our live chat room. And you can say hi to some of the finest minds on the entire Internet. A lot going on in the news, just breaking right now. Monica Goodling. Ah, my Monica. What is it about women named Monica who tend to be bringing down presidents these days? Monica Goodling has been granted immunity for testimony. What this means is not that, Monica's going to get a pass. She gets to, you know, doesn't have to go to jail, doesn't have to pay $200, all that kind of stuff. What it means is that she can no longer invoke the Fifth Amendment. That's the bottom line. And frankly, a desirable bottom line. And sometimes people who have done wrong get out as a, you know, get out of jail as a consequence of this. Ollie North was given immunity to testify, as I recall, during the Iran-Contra hearings. And he said some things in immunized testimony before the, as I recall, it was the House of Representatives, that later were referenced in his trial, and he was able to say, hey, wait a minute, you guys prosecuted me with information that was contaminated by admissions that I made under a writ of immunity, and therefore, you know, you can't use that stuff against me, and that's true. So it's possible that Monica Goodling will now go before Congress and confess to crimes for which she cannot be prosecuted. That's the bad news. The good news is that Monica Goodling, in the grand scheme of things, is not that big a deal. That big a deal part of it is that she was the number three person under Gonzalez for all practical purposes. She was a major actor in this whole, let's get these attorneys out there politicizing the prosecutions of people. Let's promote the whole idea of, oh, there's voting fraud going on, at the same time that the Republican Party was committing massive election fraud, violating a court order that they've been operating under for almost 20 years, over 20 years, against caging, breaking the rules, as Greg Palast lays out in his new book, Armed Madhouse, among others. But, you know, primarily Greg Palast, it's just amazing how none of the mainstream media in the United States are even talking about the real crimes that are at the basis, the very real crimes that are at the basis of this whole attorney scandal. And Monica Goodling in the center of it, and her testimony may reach right to George W. Bush. So she's been immunized. Her testimony has been immunized, and a fine thing it is. I mean, this is, you know, a good beginning point, an important beginning point. The story from the Associated Press, a House committee Wednesday, that's today, voted to grant immunity to Monica Goodling, a key aide to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. The 32-6 vote. Now, this is really important. Remember, 33 years ago, 2 weeks ago, when the House Judiciary Committee voted to subpoena the White House tapes from Richard Nixon, most of the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee were not going along with any idea about impeaching Nixon or anything like that. You know, they were like, yeah, okay, we'll look into this stuff. But when the evidence came out, all of them, there might have been one holdout, but I believe not. I believe that all of them then signed on, and basically the Republicans went to Nixon and said, sorry. Is that what's going to happen here? A 32-6 vote by the House Judiciary Committee surpassed the two-thirds majority required to grant a witness immunity from prosecution. And then they also authorized a subpoena for her by a voice vote. I mean, it's a given. So, number one. Number two, it's starting to look like Congressman Renzi, the Republican who is, now kind of duck and covering, shall we say. It's starting to look like Congressman Renzi may have been at the core of a problem, as it were. And that the whole Gonzalez, the Gonzo Gate here. We're back to Gonzo Gate. That Gonzo was not prosecuting Renzi before the elections. I mean, this isn't just the politicizing of attorneys. This is the entire process. I mean, this is the entire office. The Wall Street Journal reporting, John Wilk and Evan Perez. As midterm elections approached last November, federal investigators in Arizona faced unexpected obstacles in getting needed Justice Department approvals to advance a corruption investigation of Republican Representative Rick Renzi. The delays, which postponed key approvals in the case until after the election, raised new questions about whether Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez or other officials may have weighed political issues in some investigations. The Arizona U.S. attorney then overseeing the case, Paul Charlton, was told that he was being fired in December, one of eight federal prosecutors dismissed in the past year. The dismissals have triggered a wave of criticism, you know, et cetera, from the Wall Street Journal. So, again, it raises the question, and the very real and very, frankly, in my opinion, very important question, if there were crimes and improprieties involved in the firing of the guys who got fired, the men and women, the U.S. attorneys who were fired. What about the ones who weren't fired? Those are the ones that, frankly, I'm the most concerned about. And now Scott Block is inserting himself into this. And yesterday, when the story was just breaking, I mean, we were just an hour into the story when I went on the air yesterday, and I was pointing out that this is the agency, the Office of Special Counsel, that is responsible for enforcing the Hatch Act, and isn't this a great thing? More and more what's coming out. This in today's New York Times, Neil Lewis writing about this. Scott Block himself is the subject of a formal legal complaint filed by his own employees, saying that he's a Bush appointee, by the way. Surprise, surprise! Saying that he tried to dismantle the agency, that he illegally barred his own employees from talking to the news media. No, you don't have a First Amendment right of free speech, sorry. And he reduced a backlog of whistleblower complaints by simply discarding old cases. His agency has three purposes, and one of them is to represent whistleblowers. Deborah Katz, a Washington lawyer representing the employees, said it was obvious that Mr. Block was trying to use the investigation to divert attention from his own problems. She said his suggestions that he's going to launch a serious investigation into Karl Rove were, to quote Neil Lewis in today's New York Times, quoting Ms. Katz, were not believable because his office had only limited authorities in such matters. So the question before us now, is Scott Block launching this investigation into Karl Rove, A, because he himself is under fire, another corrupt Bush appointee, and he's trying to divert attention away from his own problems, as some of his employees are suggesting? Or B, is he doing it so that, because, you know, here's the scenario. Is he doing it because he got a phone call last week from Karl Rove, or some variation on this scenario, saying, hey, Scotty, you know, you and I were both appointees of our good buddy George W., and you investigate me, then I can prevent Henry Waxman from investigating me, and wouldn't that be a great thing? And Scotty goes, yeah, hey, and it'll help me out of my problem here. And so is Scott Block investigating Karl Rove as a way of setting up a situation where Karl Rove can then say to Congress, to the news media, to anybody, well, you know, I can't testify before Waxman's committee. I can't, even if I'm subpoenaed, I'm not going to show up because I'm already being investigated by the executive branch. And they're the primary, and, you know, this is a criminal investigation. You can't have Congress messing in a criminal investigation. I mean, they're investigating a violation of the Hatch Act. That's a felony. So I've been charged with a felony, and, you know, the investigation may take until we're out of office, and you know, they may never find anything wrong, but because I'm being investigated, I can't testify before Congress. Is that what you're going to hear Karl Rove saying? And yesterday I was skeptical. Today I'm convinced that that's what's going on. So we have this situation in Washington, D.C., this move towards single-party rule. Are we moving in the direction of a fascistic state? And in the process, are we dismantling the historic protections that have governmental protections of a free society and of we the people? that have made this, you know, a great nation to live in and a civil society. I want to get into both of those questions in some more detail in the first 2 hours of the program here today. And then in the third hour of our program, Pierre Epstein is going to be with us about his new book about Abraham Epstein, The Forgotten Father of Social Security. And Larry Johnson, formerly with the CIA and State Department, is going to drop in and say hi. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, The No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Balance, 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I'll tell you, this is not obviously the only stuff in the news, and I think, frankly, it's very important that we consider some of the other things that are going on out here, particularly the things that affect the lives of average Americans. I mean, right across the board. Stephen Levitin writing in today's New York Times about how 7 years ago, a Missouri doctor noticed a problem in a popcorn factory in Jasper, Missouri. They put this additive to give popcorn a more buttery flavor. They put it into the popcorn. This is a popcorn plant, right? They put this stuff in, and all of a sudden people start showing up with this god-awful lung illness. 9 workers came down with a rare, life-threatening disease that was ravaging their lungs. The doctor says it took him about 20 minutes to figure out that there was something in common between these 9 people with the same very, very rare, potentially fatal disease who all worked in the same popcorn factory. It's like, gee, let's put 2 and 2 together. So who's responsible for this? Well, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA. Did they increase plant inspections? Did they mandate safety standards? Did they say, hey, maybe we should regulate this chemical? For that matter, forget about the workers. This chemical's ending up in my food. What about the USDA? No, none of that. Once the Bush administration came into office, they said, hands off. Well, the headline in the article in the New York Times today, OSHA leaves worker safety in hands of industry. As Stephen Levitin writes, that response reflects OSHA's practices under the Bush administration, which vowed to limit new rules and roll back what it considered cumbersome regulations that imposed unnecessary costs on businesses and consumers. You've heard this mantra a million times, right? The first imperative of a for-profit corporation is to internalize profits and externalize costs, to bring the profit into the company. Oh, we can use a cheaper additive, or, you know, this additive will give us a competitive advantage. That increases profits, to bring profits into the company, and if it increases costs somewhere, to cause somebody else to pay those costs. Oh, we have a bunch of sick workers. Let's have Medicare pay for them. Or you're going to have sick consumers? Well, you know, the company doesn't have to pay for that. And this isn't limited to this popcorn company. I mean, this is just right across the board. Across Washington, as Levitin writes in today's New York Times, political appointees, often former officials of the industries they now oversee, have eased regulations or weakened enforcement rules on issues like driving hours for truckers, logging in forests, and corporate mergers. Since Bush became president, OSHA has issued the fewest significant standards in its history, public health experts say. According to this from today's New York Times, it has imposed only one major safety rule in 7 years. The only significant health standard it issued was ordered by a federal court. In the meantime, they've killed dozens of existing and proposed regulations and delayed adopting others. Why? Well, it's very simple. If you don't believe in government, you can't govern. People keep saying, oh, the Bush administration is the most incompetent administration in history. No, they're not. They're doing exactly what their philosophy dictates. They don't believe that we, the people, should even have the right to collectively get together and say, we are a society. This is a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, and in it, we can protect ourselves collectively through us creating an agency like the Occupational Safety and Health Administration that will look out for us in the workplace. They believe instead that all power should be reserved to the corporate overlords, period. As Mr. Falke says, Edwin G. Falk, maybe it's Falk, F-O-U-L-K-E, Jr., the head of OSHA, as he said, instead of regulations, they favor a voluntary compliance strategy. Industry administration officials say that less such programs are less costly. Yeah, right. Although fewer than 1% of the workforce is now covered by voluntary compliance strategies. I mean, what company is going to do this? They're going to say, yeah, sure, we'll adopt tighter standards in the workplace that will protect our workers, protect our customers, but cost us more money. No, it's not going to happen. And it's not happening. You can't govern if you don't believe in government. It is simply that simple. This is not rocket science.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This started 26 years ago, this philosophy, this bizarre notion that somehow the enemy is the institution of we the people, that our founders and the framers of this country, the framers of the Constitution, the founders of this country, and generation after generation after generation have fought and died to protect, is somehow an enemy. It's not. It's us. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
I miss Monica. She told me it's just logic. It's kind of hard to follow. It's almost pathological, and all its promises sound hollow. And the lies he tells would be hard to swallow, even for Monica, dear sweet Monica, with a cute beret and a pouting lip. She made the most of her internship and learned back then loose lips sink ships. And the scariest thing in the news was a picture of Linda Tripp. I miss Monica.
We have a new Monica coming back.
And she ruled the headlines. The world was full of promise. It was a gentler time without suicide bombers. You could share a Coca-Cola with Judge Clarence Thomas. I miss Monica. I miss Monica.
Tom Hartman here with you on listener-supported radio.
She was never appreciated.
Supported by you, our listeners, listening to your local station for our sponsors, for your opportunity to support this program by letting our sponsors know that you're listening and patronizing their products, including our national sponsors like SacredGroundsCoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, SmallDog.com, and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE. 35 minutes past the hour. Okay, I started out by telling you the story here about the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. I mean, this is all part of the same fabric from the Attorney Gate, Gonzo Gate, the whole thing of making the federal prosecutors into basically political hacks to prosecute Democrats and let Republicans off, or if they must prosecute them because the crimes are so obvious that there's no way of getting around prosecuting them, wait until after the election. From that to OSHA, to the EPA, to just pick an agency, to doctoring information on climate change, and it goes on and on and on. We started out with a story about this doctor in Missouri who all of a sudden has 9 patients within months of each other, within days of each other, who all have this rare and sometimes fatal life-threatening disease ravaging their lungs, and they all happen to work in the same factory that just started using a chemical called diacetyl to flavor their popcorn. OSHA's response was, to quote the New York Times, limited. The agency sent an inspector to the Jasper plant, but he did not test the air, saying the company's insurers had done an environmental sampling 4 years earlier. Yes, 4 years earlier, a for-profit corporation, the insurance company, had sampled the air. So OSHA doesn't need to do anything, even though you've got people really sick. 16 months after that, a lawyer for the sick workers filed a complaint with the agency, so they did finally conduct an investigation, an inspection, OSHA. Took 40 minutes. 4-0. 40 minutes. In the meantime, we're finding contaminated. It's not just pet food, apparently, and it goes beyond the pet food contamination. Remember a few months ago, or was it a few weeks ago, the peanut butter, the contaminated peanut butter, the contaminated spinach? Well, it turns out that the Food and Drug Administration has known about this for years. Years. That's with a Y. The Washington Post. Elizabeth Williamson reporting in the Washington Post. The Food and Drug Administration has known for years about contamination problems at a Georgia peanut butter plant and on California spinach farms that led to disease outbreaks that killed 3 people, sickened hundreds, and forced one of the biggest product recalls in U.S. history. Documents and interviews show. Again, internalized profits, externalized costs. As Williamson writes in the Washington Post, overwhelmed by huge growth in the number of food processors and imports, however, the agency took only limited steps to address the problems and relied on producers to police themselves, according to agency documents. That's the mantra of the Bushies. George W. did this in Texas with the oil industry, with the petrochemical industry. He said, you guys, just please police yourself. And what did they end up with? One of the most polluted states in the United States as a consequence of his governorship. Changing mandated rules into suggestions. Congressional critics, back to the Washington Post piece, congressional critics and consumer advocates say both episodes, this is the peanut butter plant and the spinach farms, show that the agency is incapable of adequately protecting the safety of the food supply. I'm sorry, it is capable of it. It's simply incapable. It's simply not willing to do it because the people who are heading these agencies up do not believe in government. As John Dingell, the Democratic congressman from Michigan, says, the administration does not like regulation. This administration does not like spending money, and it has a hostility toward government. The poisonous result is that a program like the FDA is going to suffer at every turn in the road. He's right. Again, the Washington Post. In the peanut butter case, an agency report shows that FDA inspectors checked into complaints about salmonella contamination in a ConAgra Foods factory in Georgia in 2005. Now, this is people were dying a couple of months ago. But when company managers refused to provide documents to the Food and Drug Administration, the inspectors left and didn't follow up. Why? Well, because they worked for the Bush administration, of course. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reporting today, the same food safety net that couldn't catch poisoned pet food ingredients from China has a much bigger hole, billions of dollars worth of foreign ingredients that Americans eat in everything from salad dressing to ice cream, get a pass from overwhelmed inspectors despite a rising tide of imports from countries with spotty records, according to an Associated Press analysis of federal food and trade data. Bingo. You can't govern if you don't believe in government. This is not just a scandal. And this is not just in, this has actually, frankly, nothing to do with incompetence. This has everything to do with governing philosophy. And this is what's so important to share with everybody you know, to make it, to clearly understand yourself. What happened with Katrina in New Orleans was not a mistake. It's the way conservatives govern. What is happening in Iraq right now is not a mistake. It's where you've got almost as large a force, a military force in Iraq of private contractors, where you're paying people $150,000 a year rather than GIs. It's not an accident. It's the way conservatives govern. What you have with people dying as a consequence of contaminated peanut butter and contaminated spinach, where they've known for 2 years that in this factory, salmonella contaminated water was dripping in off the roof onto the food. It's not an accident, and it's not incompetence. It's the way conservatives govern. Their philosophy is leave it to the corporations. The profit motive will ultimately win out. And, you know, it's like the worst lies are the ones that have a little bit of truth to them. And there's just enough truth to this that you know, when one of the right-wing talk show hosts goes off on it, people go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Because here's their pitch. Well, the free market actually always solves problems. If they're selling contaminated food, people will go, oh, my God, I don't want a contaminated food, and they'll stop buying it. And, yes, there's some truth to that. The problem is, A, people stop buying it after people have died, not before. It's one of the larger problems. And, B, not everybody is going to know about it. We don't live in a world where everybody's reading every FDA report or every report in the newspaper about, you know, which brands of peanut butter are contaminated or where you can't buy the spinach or whatever. I mean, all of this is post facto. It's after the fact. The laissez-faire con technique protects us after harms have happened. Well, it doesn't even protect us. It relies on the marketplace to help us make informed decisions after harms have happened. And we as a society have agreed for a long, long time, for well over a century in the United States, going back to the late 19th, early 20th century when the Food and Drug Administration came into being as a consequence of people dying from being given mercury and lead and arsenic and things as medicines. When we said, hey, wait a minute, we're going to regulate this stuff. We want people to know that their drugs are safe and that their food is safe. Sinclair Lewis, I believe it was, who wrote the novel about the meatpacking industry back in the 19-teens, as I recall. I'm sure somebody will correct me on the details of this if I have it wrong. But the something jungle, as I recall. I mean, it horrified Americans. And we said, no, we want to be protected from this. Michelle in Portland, Oregon on the line. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I was just, my husband and I have talked about this, and I think it comes to basically what you're talking about, is it really possible? It seems like it's rather impossible for democracy and capitalism to coexist because...
Well, laissez-faire capitalism. Laissez-faire, you know, absolutely unregulated capitalism works fine with a dictatorship. Look at what's happening in China right now. But a regulated capitalism like Franklin Roosevelt envisioned can coexist with democracy. We saw it work here in the United States for 40 years. But then Reagan turned the tide on that in 1980 and said, no, let's have unregulated capitalism.
Right, and that was the savings and loan and all of that's when all of that became deregulated. And so
absolutely. And it's when all the mergers and acquisition mania started and all the big companies got even bigger and bigger and bigger and we lost our media and everything else and it went nuts. Bob in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Bob, just a minute here before we got to take a break. What's up?
Thank you, Tom. I just want to compliment you on educating the people on what's really going on in this country. You're doing a wonderful job. I have a quick question regarding the ongoing investigation with Gonzalez. I remember back in November in the election when the Democrats took the majority, there was one senator, I forget his name, who was very sick in the hospital, and they said that if he died or if he was incapable, that the Democrats might lose their majority.
Yeah, it was Tim Johnson in South Dakota. And Tim is doing just fine, thank you very much. He's not able to show up and vote, but he's recovering from what could be called a stroke. It was a congenital condition.
Yeah, I remember that. I was just curious if he, in fact, is not capable, or if, God forbid, he dies, what happens? Do the Democrats lose the majority?
The Republican governor of that, then the Republican governor of that state would get to appoint the new senator, who in all probability would be a senator. But Senator Johnson is doing much better, and I don't think we have to worry about that. It's just, you know, all Democrats should be very careful about flying in small planes right now. Bob Ferdick from Democrats.com right after the break, 45 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
taking my country back. Oh, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sold them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
And there's a bunch of folks in Washington, D.C. talking about taking our country back right now. By the way, just I mentioned Sinclair Lewis. It was Upton Sinclair who wrote The Jungle about the meatpacking industry, and thanks to the caller who alerted us to that. Bob Furtick with Democrats.com, the co-founder and president of Democrats.com, on the line. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. Great to have you on with us. What's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, we're standing in front of the Capitol. We have a tremendous group of people from across the country. We have state senators and mayors like Rocky Anderson from Salt Lake City. We have poets and artists. We have peace activists like Cindy Sheehan and authors like John Nichols. And we're sending a message to Congress. Dennis Kucinich came by and gave us really an inspiring message that he has introduced his articles of impeachment. And he's starting to hear from other members, and it's in our hands now.
So, Bob, what's the? Is there a specific call for action that everybody who is standing there is endorsing, or is it a broad, you know, do something that involves holding these guys accountable sort of thing?
There's lots of specific actions. April 28th, this Saturday, is a weekend of action across the country where people are going to spell out the word impeach with their bodies. And if you go to 828.org, you'll see pictures, you'll see a map of all those locations from Central Park, New York, to North Pole, Alaska.
Right, also, 828.org, A as in April, 828.org, the website.
And we're also supporting the Kucinich impeachment bill for Vice President Cheney, which is H. Res. 333. We need to get co-sponsors. If you read the Washington Post today, there's an attack on Dennis Kucinich, making him out to be a fool. We've got to get all the Democrats to co-sponsor that impeachment. It is such a slam dunk, as George Tenet would say, that Dick Cheney needs to be impeached.
Yeah, and apparently the slam dunk was, by the way, that we can market this thing to the American people, not that it's real. You can call Congress, 202-225-3121. Call your member of the House of Representatives. If you're not sure who represents you, and many people are not, you know, they just sort of casually paying attention to politics, or they might have moved recently. If you're not sure who your member of the House of Representatives is, each one of us has one, just give me your zip code. And they will connect. They will tell you who it is, and they will connect you with that person's office. This is the number for the switchboard on Capitol Hill and at the United States Congress, the House and the Senate, 202-225-3121, 202-225-3121. Bob Furtick with Democrats.com. Bob, tell us what's happening. You said there's a whole lot of people there today. What plans for the rest of the day? What's going on?
We're going to meet members of Congress. We're going to try and find some more co-sponsors, people like Keith Ellison, who was just elected out of Minneapolis, people like Maxine Waters from Los Angeles. We know they support impeachment. We want to get them on the record. We want the media to start talking about Dennis Kucinich's bill seriously. It deserves it.
Yeah, let's get some of the mainstream, in quotes, members, not the usual suspects as well. I mean, you know, it's... I think of people like Earl Blumenauer and here in Oregon and David Wu and Darlene Hooley and Peter DeFazio. I mean, I would call on all of them to support Dennis Kucinich in this.
Absolutely. Every Democrat in the House understands that their constituents, a majority, an overwhelming majority, want impeachment. So it's time for them to stop playing the inside Washington games and to start doing the people's business. It's really... not only because of all the things they've done, it's to stop the next war in Iran, and it's to get us out of Iraq, because as long as George Bush is in the White House, our troops will be there. The only way to bring our troops home is to get George Bush out of the White House.
Yeah, and an impeachment trial, is that the right word in the House of Representatives? I believe it's a trial in the Senate. What's it called when you have an impeachment proceeding in the House, Bob?
The Judiciary Committee will hold hearings, an investigation.
Right, but the entire House, when they impeached President Clinton, Bill Clinton, and they were successful in doing so in the House, they didn't convict him in the Senate. The trial is held in the Senate. The impeachment is essentially an indictment. And there's a series of investigations that lead up to that indictment wherein the crimes are laid out. And I don't, maybe there's not a name for the process, but that impeachment process, that impeachment process is where we, the people, will be able to see clearly and hear clearly the stories of and see the evidence of the crimes that have been committed by the Bush administration, from wiretapping our phones illegally under the, against the law of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, to lying us into a war in Iraq, to I mean, it's just no shortage of things, to malfeasance, criminal malfeasance, in my opinion. Over 1,000 people dying in New Orleans as a direct consequence of their, of again, it is not incompetence. It is a criminal form of governance.
Exactly. All of the hearings that we've been watching, with the hearings yesterday on the propaganda about Pat Tillman, the hearings with Alberto Gonzalez, the story behind those scandals is always the same. There's a cabal in the White House of George Bush and Dick Cheney and Karl Rove, and for them, propaganda and lies are the way they do business. Character assassination, exposing CIA agents, no-bid contracts, corruption. It's all for the party. It's all for the big oil companies and all the other big companies. But, you know, the military-industrial complex, what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, is now a thousandfold worse than he even dreamed it would be.
These are not your father's Republicans.
That is through impeachment. It's to bring that all before the American people. The American people will be riveted, they'll be shocked, and they will demand that every member of Congress vote for impeachment when the facts are put before them.
Yeah. These are not your father's Republicans.
Well, they're not, but, you know,
no,
unless you're part of that military-industrial complex and you're getting rich, you're not benefiting, even if you're a rank-and-file Republican. So,
yeah, I mean, it was Dwight Eisenhower who said there are. It was Dwight Eisenhower who said there are some people who think that they can do away with Social Security and eviscerate labor laws. There are some millionaires in Texas. Their number is small, and they are crazy. And he was right. And now they've taken control of our government, and it's time to take it back. Bob Furtick, Democrats.com, A28.org, the website for what's going on in Washington, D.C. today. Bob, thanks for the report from Washington.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. The road to fascism? We'll talk about that next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman here with you. One of the high points of my career as a writer, and I've been writing for a lot of years, was not making the New York Times bestseller list, although that was a pretty big deal, but it was when Bill Moyers gave a speech a year or two ago and quoted an article that I had written that had first been published over at Common Dreams, and it showed up all over the internet. The man is absolutely one of my heroes. He's a genius. He is the godfather. That word has the wrong implications, I guess, these days. He's one of our wise elders when it comes to news and understanding how the world works here in the United States. And tonight on public broadcasting, which is tragically increasingly tilting right, we'll be talking about that at some more length tomorrow, in many areas now that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has been taken over by Republicans. Nonetheless, tonight on PBS, Bill Moyers' Journal is going to run an hour-long program in which Bill Moyers, it's called Buying the War, in which Bill Moyers is going to be talking about the role of the press in selling the Iraq War. So this is must-see TV. If you have a TiVo or DVR, whatever it is, set it right now to record this program tonight if you can't watch it live. And if you can, be there or be square. It's going to be a good one. Naomi Wolf wrote a piece that was published in the Guardian newspaper, one of the leading newspapers in the United Kingdom, last Tuesday. well, yesterday, in The Guardian. And in it, she points out, she starts out by pointing out that in Thailand last fall, there was a military coup. And when the military took over the government of Thailand, there was just this very tick, 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 tick series of things that they did, almost as if they were reading a script, almost as though it was all planned in advance. They shut down the radio and television stations. They took military control of communities that normally had been policed by police forces. They declared martial law. They tightened up limits on travel and started stopping people at airports and borders. They arrested people who were pro-democracy advocates or you know, who opposed some of the positions that they were taking. They clamped down on the press. They did all this stuff, tick, 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 like that, because it actually was planned in advance. And the point that Naomi Wolf makes in this piece that was published in The Guardian, it's called Fascist America in 10 Easy Steps, is that there actually is a blueprint for creating a dictatorship in a country that previously was a democracy. And it's a blueprint that we are seeing now being played out in the United States. It has been played out in a number of countries. You know, obviously the most horrific being Nazi Germany, but there's others somewhat less horrific. Franco's Spain or Mussolini's Italy or Pinochet's Chile. We've seen it all over the world. We've seen it repeatedly. And it's happening now here. And she just lays out these 10 steps in, you know, in very straightforward fashion. And this is something that we can all get. We can all understand. Number one, invoke a terrifying internal and external enemy. In other words, scare the hell out of people. 9/11 was the perfect tool for the proto-fascists or neoconservatives in our government to use to terrify Americans. And they had a complicit media going along with it because, hey, there's big money to be made in showing that footage over and over and over again and really hyping this thing. But there's a real significant difference also between how 9/11 was promoted. I mean, keep in mind, when we were hit at Pearl Harbor, that was a big news story too. But there's a significant difference between how the Bushies, the proto-fascists, the neoconservatives in this country, handled 9/11 as opposed to how the Roosevelt administration handled Pearl Harbor. Every war, or for that matter, the Madison administration handled the War of 1812. Or for that matter, how the Wilson administration handled World War I. Or how Truman and then ultimately Eisenhower resolved the Korean War. And, you know, on and on it goes. And that is that in every case, in every other war that we've been involved in, you know, even the little ones where, you know, Reagan, you know, hey, let's have a war in Grenada. It'll look good. It'll get us some PR. You know, Maggie Thatcher did really good with the Falklands. In every case, there's an end point. Right up front. Here is who the enemy is. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to win. And that's it. It's over. Explicitly, the guys in this administration said the results of 9/11 will be no end point. This is what George Orwell wrote about 1984, the perpetual war for perpetual power. The Bushies and the proto-fascists were totally explicit about this. The last time that something like this happened was in February of 1933. When the Reichstagsgebäude, the parliament building in Germany, was bombed by Marius von der Lubbe, or at least he's the guy who was arrested and executed for it. And Hitler said, there's enemies within and enemies without. And we're going to be at war with them forever. And this makes it easier for people to say, okay, we'll give up our freedoms because there's all these enemies and they're always going to be there. So I guess we're always going to have to give up our freedoms. So number one, scare people. Number two, create a gulag. Create a prison system. outside the law. It has to be outside the law where you can use torture. The first people you send there are the people that everybody agrees should probably be sent off to some horrible place. The spies, the enemies of the people, the terrible criminals, the terrorists. And then you start expanding the definition of terrorist. We saw this in Italy. We saw it in Germany. We saw it all across Latin America. We saw it in Thailand. Now we're seeing it here. The establishment of military tribunals, the Military Commissions Act, the Patriot Act. You can now be labeled a terrorist if you interrupt commercial activity. And you can then be arrested, held indefinitely, in isolation, which will cause psychosis, in and of itself a form of torture, but you can also be tortured, according to Alberto Gonzalez, as long as your organs don't fail, and never be charged with any crime. Or you can be subject to a show trial. So number two, gulags. Number three, develop a thug caste. The black shirts in Italy, the brown shirts in Germany. And now we have private security companies showing up in New Orleans. You've got gangs of angry Republicans pounding on the windows in 2000 in Florida. Stop the count, stop the count. So create a thug caste and make it acceptable to people. Number four, set up an internal surveillance system. These are the 10 steps to creating fascism in a country. This is a template, a tried and true template. Number four, set up an internal surveillance system, whether it was Mussolini's secret police or Hitler's secret police or East Germany's Stasi, communist China's secret police. It's absolutely essential to have a secret surveillance system. It actually isn't so much about gathering information. It's about scaring the citizens. It's about keeping them docile. It's about suppressing activism and dissent. People who would otherwise be out in the streets are saying, well, you know, I'm not sure I want to do that. I'll just be one of those quiet ones because I wouldn't want to lose my job. I wouldn't want to, you know, I just can't afford to, you know, be arrested for a couple of days or have a hassle. You know, I don't want my neighbor's doors being knocked on by the FBI saying we're doing a security check. Which brings us to number five, harass citizen groups. This, again, you see this with every transition from democracy to fascism, harassing or to dictatorship, harass citizens groups. And now we have over 1,500 suspicious, quote, incidents, end quote, that the Pentagon has keeping track of in more than four dozen peaceful anti-war meetings. The new laws, the new counterterrorism field activity is CIFA, part of the Department of Defense, that we are being spied on by. It's supposed to track potential terrorist threats, but they're looking at Quakers. They're looking at ladies' sewing circles. That's up to five. We'll continue the list right after the 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
So this is the British press. You get, I mean, there's a certain irony here. The British press discussing openly the rise of fascism, of dictatorship, the loss of democracy in the United States. Well, we knew that colony would never quite work out the way it should anyway. So Naomi Wolf's piece in The Guardian of the UK, guardian.co.uk, if you want to track this thing down. The first five steps we quickly covered in the first segment. Number one, invoke a terrifying internal and external enemy. Number two, create a gulag. Now, can you spell Guantanamo? Number three, develop a thug caste. Number 4, set up an internal surveillance system. Number 5, harass citizens groups. Number 6, engage in arbitrary detention and release. Why? Because it scares the hell out of people. You just never know. You just never know. And the beginning of this right now is the watch list, the TSA watch list, the no-fly list. There was a Professor Walter F. Murray. He's a professor emeritus of Princeton University, one of the best constitutional scholars in the country. He's the author of a book called Constitutional Democracy. It's a major textbook. He's also a decorated former Marine. But he showed up on the terrorist watch list and was denied the ability to board a plane at the Newark airport. And he said, you know, why? And why am I on the terrorist list? And the person there with the airline said, he'd been in any peace marches? We banned a lot of people from flying because of that. He said, well, I didn't march, but in September of 2006, I gave a lecture at Princeton, which was put on the web, that was highly critical of George Bush for violating the Constitution. And the person at the airline said, well, that'll do it. So Walter Murray is now on the no-fly list. Why? Because he dared to speak out against Bush. Engage number 6. Engage in arbitrary detentions, arrests, or persecutions, I'd say. Arbitrary detention and release. Number 7. Target key individuals. Mussolini went after the people who ran the universities. Goebbels went after academics and religious folks. Same thing with Pinochet in Chile. The same thing with the students in China. The same thing in Russia. Dissidents. They were, you know, they targeted them. They came up with a list for them. And then you lock down civil servants. You make it so that, I mean, here the Bush administration, they've targeted 700,000 civil servants to be denied the right to unionize. Why? Because they want to shut them down and shut them up. On April 7th, 1933, the Third Reich passed a law called the Reich Law for the Reestablishment of a Professional Civil Service, doing essentially the same thing. Number 8, control the press. Italy in the 20s, Germany in the 30s, East Germany in the 50s, Czechoslovakia in the 60s, Latin American dictatorships in the 70s, China in the 80s. Target the newspapers, target journalists. The Committee to Protect a Journalist says arrests of U.S. journalists are at an all-time high. Josh Wolf, for example, a blogger in San Francisco, he's been in jail for more than a year for refusing to turn over the video of an anti-war demonstration. He's still there, as far as I know. Greg Palast, oh, he just got out. Thanks, Julian. Greg Palast, who was just on this program yesterday, he was telling us when we were off the air that, you know, coming on this program and talking about how they were threatening to prosecute him for taking videotape after Hurricane Katrina caused them to stop prosecuting him. I mean, what? You have to go on the radio? Joe Wilson, his wife gets outed because he dares to tell the truth. CBS and the AP in Iraq have had staff members seized by the U.S. military and taken to violent prisons. They were not allowed to see the evidence against people in their own staffs. And then Naomi Wolf notes, over time in closing societies, which the British are suggesting we are, not a closed society, yet a closing society, in closing societies, real news is supplanted by fake news and false documents. Pinochet showed Chilean citizens falsified documents to back up his claim that terrorists had been about to attack the nation, just like the yellow cake charge in Niger. You want to have a shutdown of news in modern America, writes Naomi Wolf, but you can't have a steady stream of lies polluting the news well, as Frank Rich and Sidney Blumenthal have pointed out. This is what you already have in the White House. Number 9, saying that dissent equals treason, the 9th step moving toward fascism and dictatorship.
I think Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi are getting very, very close to treason.
That, Tom DeLay, yes, dissent equals treason. And number 10, suspend the rule of law. Like the John Warner Defense Authorization Act of 2007, which says that Bush can send the National Guard from here in Oregon, for example, to your state, to Michigan, to California, to New York, someplace where they don't feel like they are pointing their guns at friends and family. It's someplace else, and they're more likely to do what the president says rather than what the governor says over the objections of the governor. The president can now militarize the National Guards. as the New York Times editorialized, a disturbing recent phenomenon in Washington is that laws that strike to the heart of American democracy have been passed in the dead of night. Beyond actual insurrection, the president may now use military troops as a domestic police force in response to any other condition, any condition. So are we there yet? And how do we stop it? 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
Hey, join me in Dubrovnik, Croatia for the conference Transforming Culture from Empire to Global Community, June 3rd through the 9th. I'll be there with Rianne Eisler, Tom Hayden, George Lakoff, David Corton, Francis Moore LePay, Swami Beyondananda, and a bunch of other great folks. The Praxis Peace Conference, an international conference on peace in Dubrovnik, Croatia. Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, peace.org. Or you can go to tomhartman.com, and there's a link right up at the top of the page to it. If you want to join us for that week, we're actually going there, and we will be doing this show live from there. Milton Mayer, in the early 1950s, was an American, a Chicago journalist, and he was fascinated by what happened in Germany with the average Germans. And so as an American Jew, he went to Germany after World War II to interview German Christians, by and large, and ask them, how could you guys have done this? He interviewed 10 people, and he wrote a book called They Thought They Were Free, which summarizes all this. It's my BuzzFlash book of the month. It was my BuzzFlash book of the month some time back, and I think probably will be again soon. And in fact, it ties in, frankly, in my opinion, I've lost it here. I had another BuzzFlash editorial op-ed piece. We'll get to that a little later on that ties into all this stuff as well. But in any case, here, this is Milton Mayer. And his interview with Germans about what happened in Germany. And here's this German, after World War II, saying to this reporter from the United States, he says, what happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if we, the people, could understand it, it couldn't be released because of national security. Another person that Mayer interviewed said, this separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure or associated with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms, and there really were real reforms, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath, that the whole process of government was growing remoter and remoter. To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity, than most of us ever had the occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on occasion regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures that no patriotic German could resent someday must lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. And one day it's over your head. by a fellow professor in a university, told Milton Mayer, he said, Pastor Niemöller spoke for the thousands and thousands of men like me when he spoke too modestly of himself and said that when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was a little uneasy, but after all, he was not a communist, and so he did nothing, and then they attacked the socialists, and he was a little uneasier. Still, he wasn't a socialist, and he did nothing, and then the schools, the press, the Jews, and so on, and he was always uneasier, but still he did nothing, and then they attacked the church, and he was a churchman, and he did something, but then it was too late. Yes, I said, says Milton Mayer in the interview. You see, my colleague went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for the one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even to talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble. Why not? Well, you're not in the habit of doing it. It's not just fear of standing alone that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor. And instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside in the streets, in the general community, everyone seems happy. One hears no protest. You certainly see none. You know, in France or Italy, there are slogans against the government painted on walls. But in Germany, outside of the great cities, maybe, nobody even spoke of it. In the university community, my own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do. But what do you say? They say, it's not so bad. You're seeing things. You're an alarmist. And you are an alarmist. You're saying that this must lead to that, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know or even surmise what the end is going to be? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, they intimidate you. On the other hand, your colleagues poo-poo you as being pessimistic or even neurotic. And that one great shocking occasion when tens or hundreds of thousands of people will join with you never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest, thousands, millions would have been sufficiently shocked. If, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you to not to be shocked by the next. Step B is, not so much worse than step B. Excuse me, step C is not so much worse than step B. And if you didn't make a stand at B, then why should you stop at step C? And so on to step D. And one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy. And some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, Jew, swine, collapses it all at once. And you see that everything, everything has changed and changed completely under your nose. The world you believe in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, the spirit is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear. And the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without responsibility even to God.
I think Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi are getting very, very close to treason.
Tom DeLay. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Angelo in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, Angelo, what's up? Angelo? No Angelo. Okay, let's go to Bill in Queens. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Tom, you know, you've covered two topics quite eloquently in the last hour or so, which is, you know, the anti-government bias of the Republicans and the increasingly ominously fascistic tendencies of the current regime. Now,
yeah, they're anti-government in its protective capacity, or
right.
Its supportive capacity. They're pro-government in its repressive capacity.
Right. They want government to help corporations, but not people. Now, the thing is, on both of these scores, I think it's important. You know, people have to understand what are the forces at work and what can you do to counter this? And where, what direction do you turn in to organize politically to counter this? And in considering that, I think we have to tell another part of the story that you haven't made in your remarks, which is on both of these scores, the anti-government, let's take the anti-government side first. I'll go through it quickly. The DLC New Democrats, going back to the 80s and most egregiously during Clinton time, have been part of this anti-regulatory, small government.
Clinton declaring in his first inaugural that the era of big government is over.
Right, and Gore heading up the Smaller, Smarter Government Committee during Clinton time, you know. And
now, this goes back, by the way, to 3 weeks before Clinton was inaugurated, after he ran on a on an FDR platform and was elected on an FDR platform. 3 weeks before he was inaugurated, Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan sat him down and said, "Let us tell you the facts of life, son." And completely changed the direction that he was going.
I don't have to give chapter and verse. We all know it. But you know, they have been totally complicit in this and have laid down and played dead. It's not just the Republicans. Number two, on encroaching fascism, you know, the Democrats are in the leadership of Congress now, especially in the House. They have a good majority there. There is not one initiative to repeal the Patriot Act, Military Commissions Act. They're still funding the war. They have endorsed, as one of their benchmarks, the theft of Iraqi oil that was cooked up by the State Department. Now, if this is a law, if this is an opposition, I'd hate to see if they were, being complicit. I mean,
and Bill, this is why it's so important that people like you and me don't just sit around and talk about this, but get politically active.
Right, but we have to tell that side of the story to hold them accountable, and if they're not going to be accountable, organize independently.
Absolutely. This is not just about bad Republicans. This is about the entire conservative mindset that says that humans are essentially evil, whereas the liberal historic American mindset says humans are essentially good. If humans are essentially evil in the conservative worldview, which is represented in a segment of the Democratic Party as well as most of the Republican Party, then the only purpose of government is to restrain people's evil. Whereas if you think that people are inherently good, one of the main purposes of government is to help people achieve their potential. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
And in the midst of all this political news, my wife Louise just IMs me. She says that we live in a house that is, they call them floating homes here. Some people call it houseboats. You can't detach it and drive it around. So it's, you know, it's a house in the river. I mean, we're in 30 feet of water, 100 feet from the shore. And so our backyard is the river and then the forest behind it. And she just IMs me. She says, "Two geese are swimming by with 9 babies." No, it's in the next line. No, it's 10. This morning, I go out in the morning and, you know, just to spend a little time with the sky at 3:30 in the morning when I get up. And every morning I'm out on the back deck just, you know, looking up and my morning opalations. And there were 2 geese on our back deck. And, you know, the female was just sitting. And she wouldn't get up. She had 2 little yellow peepers, they just hatched in the last day or two that she was sitting on, keeping them warm during the night, and her mate was hissing at me. That's amazing. Life is such a miracle. We are so blessed to be alive and so blessed to be in this country at this time when we can actually make a difference and be part of the change, of a positive change. The BuzzFlash editorial I was telling you about was put up yesterday at BuzzFlash.com. Karl Rove's Jim Crow voter suppression machine is humming along just fine, all ready for 2008. And really, it's a brilliant expose, and I commend it to you. about how the Rove machine is moving ahead, moving along, and it's all about getting ready for the elections in 2008, the presidential elections. They're not going to take anything for granted this time, just like they didn't last time. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, what's on your mind today?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You know, you were talking about the thugs that the Germans employed. You know, the
One of the ten steps to fascism is to create a thug class.
Right. Well, the thug class here is not just physical; it's also the right-wing talk shows. They recently, because of the IMUS uproar, suddenly got very, very defensive, saying, you know, next the liberals are going to come after us. You know, and their concerted effort to make MediaMatters.org sound like something that's a conspiratorial, lie machine in order to, you know, to divert the attention of their own lying. The thugs don't necessarily have to be just physical.
Yeah, good point. Good point and well made, Len. Thanks a lot. Alan Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, the website. Hey, Alan.
Sorry, I'm a little late. Got stuck in the White House Rose Garden with the president's malaria rollout. And actually, that's a very good thing. But what's so interesting is that he supported and said that Mr. Wolfowitz was doing a good job running the World Bank. So he used the event to sort of push on Mr. Wolfowitz. The supplemental bill, Dan Aprino said today that the president would veto any deadline. And then Mark Smith and I sort of tag-teamed it, and we asked about, well, if he won't do it because essentially there is a date that may be advertised for a pullout, what about the surge? Because that's an advertised issue in terms of, well, September we'll know whether it's working or not. And then I asked, I said, well, Dana, what about the fact that, you know, the surge has now just moved people north where they killed our soldiers the other day? And she essentially said, well, there wasn't any date and that Petraeus would know whether it was working. I mean, there really wasn't a good answer to that.
Actually, the answer, Ellen, is, you know, what? Logic? How dare you use logic?
So Rahm Emanuel made a speech at the Brookings Institute today, and he said not since the days of Watergate has the judicial system and intelligence been deployed in such abuses. Partisan politics have infiltrated every level of our government. Dana Perita said about his speech that it was something you would read in the National Enquirer rather than at prestigious think tank. And then she said, well, notice I said the Brookings Institution was a prestigious think tank. Also, the special counsel, she was asked today about the special counsel, and she said that the White House has cooperated with the special counsel in the past, but they have not actually heard anything yet from the special counsel on all this Rove stuff. And not last but not least, the Judiciary Committee, 32-6, voted to give immunity to Monica Goodling. They also voted on a voice vote to subpoena her.
Indeed. Well, so we have our Monica is back, right?
Our Monica is, there's always a Monica. Also, one other really interesting thing, Senator Brownback, who, as you know, is running for president and is actually a little better on Iraq than most other Republicans, has said that he is going to add to the Senate conference bill, or at least try and get it in, a vote to petition Iraq into three different separate countries or areas as a way of actually trying to, you know, reduce some of the violence. And he wanted to do this before the president vetoed the bill.
Yeah, this was Joe Biden's suggestion back a year and a half ago, but it doesn't do much for Baghdad. I mean, it's going to be a really tough one. Ellen, this morning on the Today Show, Laura Bush was interviewed by Ann Curry. Here's a little clip of it. I'd like to get your take on this.
You know the American people are suffering, watching.
Oh, I know that very much. And believe me, no one suffers more than their president. And I do when we watch this. And certainly the commander-in-chief who has asked our military to go into harm's way.
Nobody suffers more than George and Laura.
What can I say? She's a good first lady. She supports her man.
Yeah, but nobody suffers more than her?
Well, of course. I mean, it's ridiculous. These families are suffering. They don't have money. They've often lost their only breadwinner. And, you know, parents have often lost their only child. So, I mean, I agree with you. It's not a very cool statement to have made.
And kids have lost their only dad or mother.
Right.
And, yeah,
or their only son or daughter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, I mean, how long is the Bush family going to be able to play the victim in the drama that they themselves created?
Well, they've made a career out of it.
Yeah, they certainly have. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington. Ellen, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Pierre Epstein up next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
We've been talking today about and welcome back. We've been talking about the fundamental notion of what government is and how it should function, ranging from the ideologically conservative perspective, and this goes back all the way back to Thomas Hobbes in the early 1600s, the conservative notion that humans are so inherently flawed and so inherently evil that without, as Hobbes wrote about in his book Leviathan in the 1630s or 1640s, that without the iron force of church or state restraining them, their natural evil impulses would come out. And so in the conservative worldview, you know, the idea of a fascistic government is just a fine thing because the main purpose of government is to restrain people because everybody is essentially evil. So you have government for police, you have government for armies, and you have and government for power, basically. And we're seeing this played out, you know, writ large today in countries all across the world, and that's part of the battle that's going on in the United States. What kind of government are we going to have? And then there came along the liberal worldview in the later 1600s, the 1670s, 1680s, John Locke writing his second treatise on government, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the early philosophers of the Enlightenment in the 1700s, philosophers and authors like Thomas Jefferson, suggesting, no, the inherent nature of people is good, that goodness is part of who we are, it's what we're all about. And the purpose of government, yeah, of course, we need to protect ourselves from threats, external and internal, from the occasional crazy person, but fundamentally, the primary purpose of government is to allow all of us to achieve the potential which is within us of extraordinary goodness and brilliance and inventiveness and bring about a world in which we all want to work, to live and work to make that happen. That governments are instituted among men for the purposes of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Not restraint and fear and intimidation. And one of the major turning points in contemporary America in the last century in taking us back to that original founding vision of America as an egalitarian liberal democracy, a democratic, you know, a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, was the New Deal, and a core piece of the New Deal was the program called Social Security. Abraham Epstein is one of the great thinkers behind Social Security, and his son, Pierre Epstein, has written a new book. Pierre Epstein has written a new book called Abraham Epstein, the Forgotten Father of Social Security. Pierre, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you. Tell us about your father's role in bringing about Social Security.
My father's role was basically that he was probably the primary lobbyist for the creation of social insurance legislation in the United States. He worked tirelessly to see that the old, the unemployed, and the sick received some form of benefit from a government that just was indifferent to their existence. And I always think back to the fact that if in 1930, when we had the terrible depression in the United States, we had some form of unemployment insurance, some form of old age insurance or medical care, we would have not have been in terrible shape. The terrible things would not have happened to the poor here. You know that in England they had some form of unemployment insurance already in 1926. So those countries, England and France and even parts of Germany, did not suffer any way as severely the results of the Depression as the United States did.
You know, we tried in the 1905, somewhere between 1905
right.
and 1915, we tried to have this, and the Supreme Court ruled it illegal.
Right, and Progressive Era, Teddy Roosevelt, and many people like that tried very hard. As a matter of fact, health insurance almost passed in Congress in 1906, from my research, I found out.
Yeah, national
it lost by not a great deal, but it did lose, you know. And then, of course, we got the worst form of republicanism after the First World War, and it lasted all until the Depression hit and finally proved them how bad they were, you know.
Right, the Republican Great Depression. Now, you, Pierre Epstein.
Epstein,
thank you. I'm sorry, I'm always, I have a friend who pronounces his, in any case, Pierre Epstein. You used a word when you first were describing this program that your father helped create, that, in my opinion, is the Holy Grail. This is the magic word that we need
right.
to reincorporate into our language, and that's the word insurance.
Right, right.
This is an insurance program. It's an insurance program against poverty and the vicissitudes of life that
right.
we can't predict. Or
right.
those that we can predict, things like old age, but essentially poverty and old age, or
right.
poverty and my friend Michael Hutchison in Santa Fe, who broke his neck, and he's paralyzed from his neck down. He's on Social Security.
Oh, boy.
It's a terrible situation, but thank God Social Security is there for
right,
you.
Right, right.
Or literally, widows and orphans. This is an insurance program. Speak to that, please.
Well, it's more than an insurance program, because that was, I think, the great concept that Abraham Epstein talked about. And I point that out in my book, and how he and Roosevelt actually philosophically became closer and closer, even though they didn't communicate, because the concept is really about not insuring individuals like Michael Hutchison, as unfortunate as that may be, but insuring the society as a whole, so that any downturn, large groups of people who suffer, you know, for reasons that are due mostly to economics or illness, will receive some form of help, some means of getting by, some means of surviving, so that the country is not, you know, forced to take drastic measures to change everything. And that's, so it's a form of social insurance that is much larger than just individual insurance, which you might call an insurance company. And
right,
FDR.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Now, FDR, in the second to last year of his life, he made a State of the Union speech in which he proposed 10 a Bill of Rights for economics, in which
right.
was included Social Security. And I think that these are concepts that we're about to throw out the window, but basically that economic security, Social Security, is vital to the health of a democracy. Without it, we might just go right down the toilet once again.
Yeah, well said. In fact, Cass Sunstein, the brilliant professor
right.
at the University of Chicago, wrote a book about Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights.
Right, yeah, and I think that book is very important, and I think, you know, its significance is ignored. And I also think he may have gotten some of the concepts from Abe Epstein, because Abe was talking about this stuff for a long time, also in the 1930s, and when he pioneered, you know, and it's in the book, he pioneered the word Social Security, everybody laughed at him and said, forget it, this is ridiculous, you want too much. But the concept is still there, and we call it Social Security. We don't call it social insurance, we don't call it this, we call it Social Security, because social means it's for everybody, for the whole country. And I think that is a very, to me, a very moving and deeply human thing.
Yeah, and we're talking with Pierre Epstein, and his book, Abraham Epstein, The Forgotten Father of Social Security, the website fatherofsocialsecurity.com. This, by the way, our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, and it's sponsored by theliberalstore.com. All things liberal and bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Go check out the liberal teddy bear there. theliberalstore.com. And Pierre,
yeah.
the right-wing meme right now, I mean, the ultimate goal here is that they want to destroy Social Security.
Sure they do.
You know, Limbaugh is pretty outspoken about it.
Oh,
I mean, he just comes right out and says it. And the tool that they're using to do this is pointing out that there's this demographic change coming down the road.
Right.
And the Social Security system is going to become bankrupt. Not true.
No, I don't believe it's true at all, and I think if you talk to people like Paul Krugman, you'll find out that it's not true one bit. There are issues with Medicare, and there are issues with Medicaid, and these are health insurance in general in this country. Medicare is only one part of a huge health insurance problem that has been ignored at our peril for many, many years, whereas most of the European countries have managed to tackle the problem, you know, with a nationalized and universal plan. But Social Security needs only a few minor adjustments to make it viable, you know, as all the way to the end of the 21st century, you know, and there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of wrong numbers out there that are used to scare people, and of course people are easily scared nowadays, I'm afraid.
Yeah. And then you've got guys on the right like Limbaugh going...
Roosevelt is dead! His
right.
policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
I mean, they're unambiguous about it. You know, they're just anything that had to do with Roosevelt, they're trying to end. So,
of course they are, and for one very good reason, because Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was from business, managed to put business in its place because he showed, and he told them, basically said, look, you have made a mess of things, and I'm going to get you out of this, but you better let me do it and not try to do it yourself. And I think that's the Roosevelt lesson. He didn't change capitalism. Capitalism's as strong as ever.
He saved it from itself. Yeah, indeed. He made it possible for it to survive. Absolutely. Pierre Epstein, his book, The Father of Social Security, Abraham Epstein, The Forgotten Father of Social Security, fathersocialsecurity.com. Pierre, thanks for being with us today.
Very much. Thank you very much, Tom. Goodbye.
Good speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Larry Johnson, the CIA and the State Department, up next.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Johnson on the line with us. His blog, noquarter.typepad.com, a former Central Intelligence Agency and U.S. State Department officer with the Department of Counterterrorism. Larry, welcome.
Hey, Tom. How are you, man?
Just great. Great to have you with us. Your news flash over at your website at noquarter.typepad.com. The White House doesn't protect classified documents or people.
Yeah, well, they've got a pretty consistent track record on that so far, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is like Valerie Plame Redux, right?
Yeah, you start with the outing of Valerie Plame, and then you get all this other documents, all this material go missing. Sounds like someone needs a rudimentary class on how to, you know, keep track of important stuff.
Don't you think, though, that, I'm guessing that there's a certain, maybe a very large element of sarcasm in your point, beyond just irony. I mean, first of all, we know that Bush, you know, the whole, you know, leaking of Valerie Plame's identity, your friend Valerie Plame, that, you know, Bush came out and said.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration. And there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Turns out it was Rove.
Right.
Right. Okay. So number one.
Rove, Libby, Cheney, you know, one of many.
Yeah. There was a conspiracy, basically, in the White House to do this. And, you know, it was 33 years ago, the week before last, that the House Judiciary Committee subpoenaed the White House for the White House tapes, the Nixon White House. And the majority of Republicans at that point would not even discuss the word impeachment. Democrats were reluctant to use the word impeachment. A few months later, Nixon actually coughed up the tapes. And within a week of the time that Congress had heard those tapes, virtually all of the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee said that they were willing to vote for impeachment. I'm of the opinion that the reason that Karl Rove, from the very get-go, the reason why these guys were using these RNC servers, which, by the way, were the same servers we have apparently have just discovered, were the same servers that the governor of Ohio, the Secretary of State and the governor of Ohio, were using in 2004 to track the vote in Ohio, where they had that famous six-hour gap where all of a sudden all the votes in Ohio, when it looked like Kerry was going to win Ohio, all of a sudden their systems froze
right.
up.
And right.
that it was the same servers out of Tennessee that Rove was using, the RNC servers that Rove was using for his emails. And I, A, don't find that to be a coincidence, and B, I have a feeling that those servers have since been upgraded. The old hard drives are in the bottom of a lake someplace.
Well, I hope that that's not the case, but I think in the day what we see is a deliberate effort by Rove and others to try to circumvent the normal oversight that's supposed to accompany government officials who work in the White House and to ensure that there are no violations of the Hatch Act. And I think it didn't, you know, unfortunately with this group, everything is political to them. There's no such thing as principle. There's no such thing as right and wrong. It's all through a political lens. And I really sincerely wish that the Democrats would stop allowing themselves to get painted into a corner as being just political hacks instead of saying, you know, it's one thing to impeach a president over lying about oral sex with an intern or perjury in a sexual matter. But it's another thing when you start talking about impeaching the president and vice president for taking the country to war under false pretenses. That is not politics. That's doing the right thing for the right reason.
Well, here's an interesting theory, Larry. I'd like your take on this. You've got a bunch of guys who are planning to take power in the White House and in Congress. They've put into place a massive and illegal conspiracy to rig, not so much to rig votes, but to disenfranchise voters, to knock 90,000 African Americans off the voting rolls in Florida, to push over 150,000 people off the voting rolls in Ohio, et cetera, across the country. We're talking about back in 1999,
right.
2000.
Right.
Okay, they put this system into place to seize power, and they realize that once they've seized power, the things that they're going to do are going to be fundamentally against the law. And so they set up a parallel system of communication so that, you know, with the RNC servers and all this kind of stuff. But they also, back even 4 years before that, when they're planning this stuff in 96, they're saying, when we have power, we don't ever want to be held to account. So we're going to perpetrate an impeachment process against a Democratic president that is openly and nakedly political so that the Democrats will be afraid to use impeachment against us when we actually commit crimes. Is that too much of a conspiracy nut stretch?
I would say probably, but it's both creative and it is not so far-fetched given what we've seen. This much I know for certain. I've got a good friend who was friends with Abramoff, and Abramoff told my friend, in no uncertain terms, that Rove was going to go down over this whole thing. That if there's evidence out there, out of the Abramoff case, that should take Karl Rove down. Whether that happens or not remains to be seen, but when you look at the entire scheme of what has taken place, the voting fraud, the effort to circumvent normal email procedures and security, the firing of the justice, the U.S. attorneys, to see a scheme that is, you know, appears to be orchestrated to really take power away from the American people and to consolidate it in a group of people. You know, I come up with the term fascism. That sounds over the top. But it's
no,
really,
it's been the theme of our program today, Larry. It really
like
has.
It feels like it is.
Yeah, amen. Larry Johnson, noquarter.typepad.com. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
I don't think so. By 20 to 10, 21 to 10. As Forbes is reporting, the House Oversight Committee voted to issue a subpoena to Condoleezza Rice to compel her story on the Bush administration's claim, now discredited, that Iraq was seeking uranium from Niger. They also issued subpoenas for the Republican National Committee for testimony and documents about White House emails on RNC accounts that have apparently gone missing. They approved but did not issue a subpoena on the prosecutor's matter to Sarah Taylor, a deputy to Karl Rove. Moving in. They're moving in. Will they find the smoking guns, or has this, what I think is essentially a criminal conspiracy within the Republican Party that has in large part taken control of that party and taken control of the Bush White House, or perhaps should be described as the Bush White House, will they have succeeded in destroying all the evidence before these guys can get to it? Hutch in Wayne, New Jersey. Hey, Hutch, what's up? Hutch? John in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I read the other day in the Financial Times that the, the Medicare bill and the Democrats proposal that we need to bargain for the price.
Right, to allow the government to negotiate for pharmaceutical prices from the drug companies.
Yes, but what's happening is it seems the Democrats, this time they did not have the votes sufficient to...
Right, they had 60 votes in the Senate because Big Pharma has been running all these ads on TV saying, everything's just fine, it's just great that you have to pay full retail. This is called competition.
Yeah, but the Republicans are, what do you call that? They had the sufficient votes so that they are talking the thing down.
That's right. It's a filibuster, in effect. Although nobody's using that word in the media.
So, and why is it that no newspaper I have seen that had published this thing, and also that everyone should
Go ahead, John.
Yes,
sir.
1 minute. Everyone should call their senators and whoever the senators that they find out voted against this, this proposal, they should next time throw them out.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all, John. And number one, you have the reason that nobody's reporting on this in the mainstream media is because you have a bunch of very, very large corporations who have interlocking boards of directors. Go to theyrule.net and just plug in any random two companies. Start with a media company and then a pharmaceutical company. And it'll boggle your mind. The links that you'll find between them. One of these days we'll do it on the air here. It's been a while since I've done it. But I don't have the time to set it up right now. 1-866-303-2270, James in Santa Rosa. Hey, James, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Thank you for opening up this whole question of conspiracy theory. You know, a wild guess becomes a theory for a reason. And then it becomes a possibility and then a probability. Dave von Kleist has laid this out very well in his video. Another video, Lemnitzer in 1962, Joint Chiefs of Staff, proposed to President John F. Kennedy a fake attack by Cuba on us. That we would stage so that we would have a reason to wipe out Cuba off the map and get rid of Castro, etc. So regime change and wars by choice is not a new thing. It goes back to at least the 1960s.
Oh, it goes back to, remember the Maine. I mean, this goes back to the Spanish-American War.
The annexation of Texas, California, how far back?
Yeah.
Native Americans.
Certainly goes back to the 19th century, yeah.
Sure.
Good point, James. I just wonder, did the Republicans impeach Clinton because they wanted to poison the word impeachment so that they would never have to suffer that fate when they got power, or did they impeach Clinton because they were really and truly trying to screw up Clinton's presidency? Or was it a twofer? I think there's a good chance, a good argument to be made that it was a twofer. Ellen in Lowell, Massachusetts. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
Hi. I tell you, I've been interested in your tag you at the end of the show. I think that's so great, and I believe in getting involved. And I've been thrilled with the idea that in Vermont that the state is voting on the idea of impeachment.
Yes,
and I was going, well, this is neat. We should get more states interested in this kind of thing. My husband's had extra training in law, and we were talking about it. He goes, oh, no, that won't work. That's two different branches of the government. I said, I know it's two different branches of the government, but do you think it would make any difference if everybody in the state was going, let's do it, let's do it, let's do it, and if all the states did it?
It's beyond just a bandwagon thing, Ellen. According to the rules for the House of Representatives that Thomas Jefferson wrote, it's sort of a little handbook of how the thing works. Because there's a lot of stuff that's not in the Constitution explicitly laid out. And so this has basically been, you know, the book that everybody has used for 230-some-odd years.
Exactly.
If a state legislature submits articles of impeachment to the House of Representatives, then it doesn't have to go through committee. It goes directly to the floor of the House of Representatives and has to be debated and voted on by the entire House of Representatives. Dennis Kucinich introduced yesterday articles of impeachment, or either late yesterday afternoon or early this morning, articles of impeachment against Dick Cheney. And the problem is that that is going to have to be introduced into a committee, the committee, probably the Judiciary Committee. The committee is going to have to decide whether or not to refer it out to the House at large for debate. And the Speaker of the House gets to decide whether or not it's even going to be brought up. And odds are it won't make it out of committee. And if it does make it out of committee, odds are that Nancy Pelosi won't bring it up unless all of these politicians hear from enough of us. But if the state of Vermont, if both the House and the Senate of the state of Vermont vote for the impeachment of Bush and Cheney, and that gets submitted to the House of Representatives, then according to my understanding of Jefferson's rules, it's not up to the committee chairman, in this case John Conyers in the Judiciary Committee, and it's not up to the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. It simply goes to the floor of the House of Representatives to be debated. Now, the debate may only last 30 seconds, but nonetheless, it gets there. And so that's why, and it's not just Vermont that's doing this. There's a number of states around the country that are working on this, and that's how it works. And I think it's a marvelous thing, and I'd like to see more of it. Good on them. Ed in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Boy, what a great show you have, as always, Tom. Whatever happened to the Carol Lam investigation? Are they still going on, or have they been deep six?
To the best of my knowledge, all of Carol Lam's investigations into Republicans like Jerry Lewis have been either stopped or put more probably permanently on hold.
Be real interesting to find out specifically what's going on there.
Yeah, I have asked several times. I've tried to look into that, and as far as I can tell, all those investigations have just evaporated into thin air, which, you know, frankly shouldn't surprise us. Ed, thanks for the call. Patrice in Greenfield, Mass.
Hi, Tom. On the subject of impeachment, the town of Greenfield the town council members of Greenfield, Massachusetts, will be meeting on May 16th to discuss whether or not to transmit a resolution to the House for the impeachment of Dick Cheney and George Bush. And so I would like, with your permission, to take this opportunity just to get the attention of your Greenfield, Massachusetts listeners and urge them to contact their town council member. They can find out who that is if they call 772-1555, and to call their council member and to really encourage them to vote for this. I think enough is enough. I mean, every week we have a different scandal, and we can see the pattern that's developing. And it's unfortunate that Nancy Pelosi has taken this off, impeachment off the table.
I think her statement that she's taking it off the table is because she is the next in line. So for her to advocate for it, I mean, it's my recollection, I may be wrong on this, but my recollection of when Clinton was impeached was that it wasn't the Speaker's office that was driving it. You had these floor managers like Bob Barr and Livingston who were driving the process, because it would be unseemly and perhaps even, you know, inappropriate, maybe even legally inappropriate, for the Speaker, who would become president if both the President and Vice President were impeached, to be, you know, arguing for that. So politically, maybe there was something there. But Patrice, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to WNHP or HNP there in Greenfield. Much appreciated. Ray and for calling out to your friends. Ray in Nutley, New Jersey. Hey, Ray.
Hey, good morning. Good afternoon, Tom. Tom, I was just calling because you had that Mr. Epstein on the phone, and about 5 or 6 years ago, my mom gave me a book on the Social Security system that was so incessant. I was so incensed reading it that I had to actually stop reading the book. I would find myself sitting in bed at night thinking about this, that, and the other thing. I had to stop reading it. You know, it seems that when we hear politicians and some of the radio announcers talk to us about the Social Security system going bankrupt, they talk as if it's our fault, when in truth, only 13 cents out of every dollar that gets put into Social Security is actually paid out to Social Security recipients. The other 87 cents is being spent on government overspending. And
well, actually, it's
thing.
Not being spent. I'm sorry, Ray, you're wrong. It's not being spent. It's being borrowed, and we are paying interest on it, and that money will be repaid. It's just, you're just wrong. I mean, it's very, very simple. You're just wrong. I'm sorry. I mean, Social Security operates on an overhead of less than 3%. It's a very efficient system. It's never failed to pay a check, and it won't. So, you know, I encourage you to put that book in a category with John Stormer's None Dare Call It Treason, you know, right-wing propaganda. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow. Carefully.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Hey, it looks like next week, Stephanie Miller, the progressive talk show host, is going to be filling in for Imus's slot on MSNBC. So you can let MSNBC know that you would like to have a progressive there. Stephanie is great, and I'm sure she'll do a marvelous job. So good on her, and congratulations. It's absolutely marvelous. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Dennis Kucinich filed an impeachment resolution against Dick Cheney yesterday, and you've been talking about it a lot and had Bob Furtick on, and that was great. So I was all energized. I called every congressperson, senator I could think of. I called Conyers, the Judiciary Committee, made sure I got all those bases covered. And so I thought for sure today when I open up my morning paper, I'm going to see an article about this. Nothing. I checked the New York Times. Nothing. And
nothing
I'm just
in my
amazed.
Paper either. Yeah, nothing in my paper either. And
yeah, and the only way we're going to fix that problem is if we start calling these newsrooms, and maybe we got to start staging these impeachment rallies right outside the newspaper.
Yeah, there are three things, in my opinion, that we all can do that have quick and measurable impact. Number one is contact our elected members of actually four things. Number one, contact your elected members of Congress, so, you know, the House of Representatives, the Senate, local, you know, your state and state senator, your state representatives, assemblyman, whatever you may have, you know, right on down to the mayor's office. I mean, you know, contact people and say, this is an issue that I care about, whatever the issue may be. And this, I mean, we're talking about impeachment here, but whatever the issue may be. Number one, let elected people know. Number two, participate in the political process. Show up at the local Green Party meetings. Show up at the local Democratic Party meetings. Show up at the local Republican Party meetings if you're so inclined. I mean, let's see that party be taken back by good people of goodwill who just happen to have a different governing philosophy or whatever. Number three, support progressive media. Let the advertisers of the radio stations and television stations that are carrying progressive programming know that you are listening or you are watching, and that you will patronize their products, particularly with radio, particularly the local sponsors. It's so important that they hear from listeners. That, you know, an occasional call to a sponsor is a huge big deal in this business. And number four, keep up the pressure. You write your letters to the editor, call into talk radio, like what you're doing right now, Jeff, and contact the media themselves and say, hey, listen, I picked up the paper today, and I don't see any stories about Dennis Kucinich and the impeachment thing. And, you know, what's going on? Why not? I was expecting to see this. I don't want to have to, go to the web to find this stuff. This is a guy who's running for president. This was, a major member of the last time around. So Jeff's spot on, and thank you very much for calling and sharing that. Hutch in Wayne, New Jersey. Hey, Hutch. Apparently, I got the wrong one here. Mark in Florence, Oregon. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Morning to you, Tom. Tom, it's past time and also still very timely and useful to expose through a multitude of very well-documented facts and evidence who was really behind the 9/11 attacks. And the London and Madrid and train bombings also, the facts and all of the evidence indicate that the organizers and sponsors of these three terrorist attacks are to be found in the political leadership and intelligence apparatus of these three countries. The issue of terrorism must be removed from its purpose of abusive control of the people of this country and the people of the world. And I would just strongly...
And let us not forget also about Pakistan and Saudi Arabia's role in all of this.
Absolutely. And I would finish by just asking you, Tom, to please have such as Alex Jones on to educate us all on what happened
on
9/11.
Alex has been on this program. David Ray Griffin has been on this program three times. We talk with some regularity about it. My position on this, Mark, is that we need to have a serious investigation. But this is like the Kennedy killing after, you know, within the first decade after Kennedy was assassinated.
Absolutely.
It took us 40 years to figure out what was going on. They're still arguing. There was a book published in Germany, it's not available in English, last year, suggesting that Marius van der Lubbe, the guy who burned the Reichstag, you know, the
yeah.
parliament building in Germany in February yeah. 1933, that
yeah.
Marius van der Lubbe actually was acting independent of Hitler and the Stasi, or the Brown Shirts at that time, you know, which was a private organization at the
yes.
time. That he really was, you know, and, I mean, they're still debating that. They're still debating the burning of the Reichstag, the parliament building, which happened in 1933. So I don't think that you know the answer. I certainly don't know the answer, and I don't believe for a second that the 9/11 Commission knows the answer. We need serious investigations, you know, before any of us say, oh, this is what it is. But you're absolutely right to be holding up. This is where the evidence seems to be pointing, and it's not good. It's downright scary, in fact. Lynette in Portland. Hey, Lynette, what's on your mind today?
Well, first, I want to say that I'm so glad you were on the air in Portland, and now I'm even happier that you're on the air nationally.
Well, thank you.
I have a quick comment and then a question for you. I just noticed that doesn't seem to be much talk lately about creating a strong executive, and it seems to be tied
yeah.
with maybe now the oversight that the Democrats are doing.
But, it could be, or it could be that the Republicans are concerned that if a Democrat becomes the president, they don't want that person to have as much power as Bush has right now.
Exactly, which speaks to the fact that they were that sure of getting the presidential election in 2000.
Oh, Karl Rove was bragging that they were going to have a Republican majority for 100 years. I mean, this is the same way Hitler was bragging that he was going to have a Reich that lasted 1,000 years.
Amazing, huh? But my question is about Monica Goodling. I don't understand the legal system. So it seems to me, given that she's now gained immunity, what's to stop her from taking the stand or going before the grand jury and just taking the fall for everyone and saying it's all me? Now they can't.
Because she could only do that if it was truthful, Lynette. She is not immunized against perjury. That's the one thing that she does not have immunity for. So if she takes the stand and she lies, she will go to jail for a long, long, long time. And that's the whole point of giving somebody immunity when they testify before Congress, is that they must tell the truth. And they can tell any truth at all, even truth that incriminates them, and they won't go to jail for it. But if they lie, they're nailed. And that's why it's a great thing, that, in my opinion, that Congress gave Monica Goodling this immunity. Thanks a lot for your call. Tomorrow, conservative Keith Lockovich is going to be here. Jonathan Cohen dropping by on the untold story of America's health crisis. As always, the best of the rest of the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your radio support group for We the People. And never forget, democracy begins with you, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it! See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online.